This is the Popmatic Podcast for July 22nd, 2015.
How long is the line for this gas?
This is the Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and joining me today are...
Amina.
Mac.
Jeremy.
And Bill.
As you can hear, we are recording today from the bottom of the elevator shaft at the main library.
It's cozy.
If anyone takes the elevator the whole way down to the loading dock, we'll have to scramble. We will be recording in impromptu locations while the children's department gets remodeled. Now, as you might have heard... President Carter will be here Thursday, July 23rd. That would be tomorrow. If you're listening the day this episode comes out. He's going to sign books. So to honor President Carter, we thought we would do our version of That 70s Show.
Don't get into malaise. Hang out with us.
Hopefully this episode won't crash and burn as hard as Paul Thomas Anderson's film version of Inherent Vice.
Oh.
Mr. Estes, swallow that coffee.
Gulp.
You're up first today.
From 1977 to 1979, Elvis Costello released three incredible albums, My Aim Is True, This Year's Model, and Armed Forces. They were all at once completely distinct from one another, but also a cohesive trilogy of a young artist flexing his creative muscles and growing into a star. Now, a lot of people might associate Costello with the 1980s because of hits like Every Day I Write the Book and Veronica, but his career began on the heels of the pub rock scene in England, a club-based old-school rock and roll movement whose London epicenter featured bands like Brinsley Schwartz, with Costello's producer Nick Lowe playing the bass and not getting the ladies, and Joe Strummer's pre-Clash band The 101ers. It was also a crucial precursor to English punk rock.
Once upon a time I had a little money. Government burglars took it long before I could mail it to you. Still, you are the only one that I can't let it slip away. So here's the man with the ticker tape that tried to take it. This is what I'm gonna say. Blame it on Kane.
My Aim Is True owes more to roots rock groups like The Band than to the Sex Pistols, but punk rock was the flavor of the day, and good timing mixed with a handful of angry songs found Costello lumped in with that crowd. Of course, also the punk tent was a lot bigger back then, so it wasn't all Warped Tour and Van's shoes. And by his second album, Costello was joined by his backing band, The Attractions, featuring Steve Naive on keyboards, Bruce Thomas on bass, and Pete Thomas, no relation, on drums. And the combined might was like Voltron and the Power Rangers having a rock and roll baby or something in the 70s. With the exception of Bruce Thomas, these musicians still play with Costello to this very day. And they're going to be playing next month at the new Ascend Amphitheater with Steely Dan. So I probably won't go.
You have something against Steely Dan?
I don't dislike Steely Dan, but I don't like Steely Dan. If Steely Dan was opening, I would go and be like, Steely Dan's opening, but like Steely Dan is the headliner, so I don't really care. By 1979, the crest of punk rock broke and new wave reigned, and suddenly labels that meant nothing in the first place began to give way to cocaine and synthesizers. Now, Armed Forces, which was originally titled Emotional Fascism, which I'm sure Brian will use as the title of his forthcoming memoir, featured the Nick Lowe penned What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding. And this would find Costello ending the 1970s on a professional high note in a personal purgatory thanks to marital infidelity and some unfortunate words uttered at a bar in Columbus, Ohio. For more on that, check out the internet's number one source for information, Micopedia.
Hey, that sounds like me.
The library only owns physical copies of Costello's debut, 1977's My Aim Is True, but all of these albums and more are available to stream on Hoopla, as is the excellent 1978 live album, Live at El Mocambo. You can also get a look at Costello in his 1970s heyday on the great DVD compilation The Right Spectacle, a collection of videos, live performances, and TV appearances from the beginning of his career right up until the early 1990s. There were some pretty awkward stabs at video making there in the pre-MTV days, with Costello doing his best to bring his angry young man persona alive in front of the camera, but the real deal is on full display during live performances of songs like Lip Service and Radio Radio. So check it out. Don't bring me
down. I've tried to like Elvis Costello forever, but the only song of his I like is it Allison? Is that the uh-huh. name? Yeah. And I only like it because it was in an episode of That 70s Show.
Have you seen Notting Hill? He did the song in that movie.
He did Notting Hill too?
He sang, she
was... Oh, that's a sad song. I don't like that song.
That can be really shallow when it comes to music. I don't like his voice at all.
That's a lot of people don't. It's not for everyone.
Like, I think everybody's like, he's such a witty songwriter. And I'm like, Allison.
Yeah, you know. It's the same with Dylan. It's like the voice drives me nuts so bad. Yeah,
I mean, how did he get a recording contract?
Yeah,
he has a better voice than Bob Dylan.
Yes, he does.
He has a better voice than Bob Dylan, and he's also, like, people talk about Bob Dylan lyrically, and lots of people have been tagged with that next new Dylan thing. Springsteen got a lot of that. I think Costello is like can write a melody that will put any melody that Bob Dylan wrote to shame.
That's fair. You
know, but I don't know that
that's... Snob car that no one cares about.
Pardon me, would you have any gray poop?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know that that's the point.
We all played it.
I don't know that that... Table is
filled. Oh.
But he also, like, he has the, to use a $2 word, he's like a dilettante, because, like, he's put out an album of recorded with a string quartet, and he did an album with Burt Bacharach, and he did an album with the Mingus Big Band, and he did an album with the Roots, and... Mm-hmm. He's like appearing on this, and he appears on that, and he hosted Late Night with David Letterman one time when Letterman had shingles. And
is there any project this guy will turn down?
That's sort of become a thing in recent years.
And he was on Two and a Half Men.
He was on Two and a Half Men. He was on the final episode of Third Rock from the Sun.
He was on Ricky Bobby. He was sitting at the dinner table.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I like it when him and Abbott met the Wolfman.
And his kids will go to college wherever he wants. You know what? Maybe we do pick on Jeremy.
Yeah.
This is like, you know,
well, I pick on everybody in this thing except for Bill and Amanda.
I did like sort of have digs at both of you.
Yeah.
Because it's like one of his favorite musicians. He's obviously really talented, and then we're dissing him. There's no reason.
I think like the first episode he got on here, I was like, yeah, well, Upscale sucks, but Metallica's awesome. And then I felt bad about it afterwards. I was like, that's good.
Hurt my feelings.
Kind of a jerk move.
He's my favorite.
We have to bring you down cards for a reason.
That's true.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, you got to deploy them, you know, more than... You know,
ELO is maybe like sort of like just a little bit below there in my favorite music, so...
Bill, can you dig us out of Jeremy's narcissistic pit?
I would be glad to.
You guys put the mirror in there.
I'm sorry. I always gotta go for the joke.
Right. Sorry. Well, thank Jeremy.
Now we're going in a paranoid. Been watching a documentary about the 70s on CNN, and it's appropriate called The 70s. One of the more interesting facts during that time, we were coming out of Vietnam, Watergate was happening, and violent crime was on the upswing. In America during this time, there was such a great deal of paranoia, you couldn't trust our institutions, and you didn't know where to turn. Movies of this era reflected this, such as Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation, starring Gene Hackman, as Harry Call, a professional surveillance expert.
This is a world of hidden mics and two-way mirrors. A world where nothing is private.
You think we can do this?
Later in the week.
You think we can do this?
Harry Call is an expert. The best there is.
Let me tell you something about Harry Call. The best, bar none. I'll drink to that.
Best what?
The best bugger on the West Coast.
What about me?
He can bug anybody, anytime, anywhere.
Nobody knows how you did it, though, Harry. It caused a hell of a scandal, too.
Look, did you see him? The man with the hearing aid, like Charles. He's been following us all.
They're not people to him. Just voices.
Three people were murdered, that's all.
He doesn't know them, and they don't know him.
It had nothing to do with me. I mean, I just turned in the tapes.
Bless me, Father, for absent. I've been involved in some work that I think will be used
you
to hurt these two young people. No way responsible. I'm not responsible.
You're not supposed to feel anything about it. You're just supposed to do it.
Be careful, Harry. You're just supposed to listen. Not look. Not feel. Not care.
Now, his name's Harry Call. Get it? Okay, I'll go on.
I got it.
And he's recording the conversation of a couple who we never find out who they are. And Harry Call is employed by a corporation that we don't know what the corporation is all about, but murder is in the picture. The conversation came out a few months before Nixon resigned from office, and everyone thought it was a response to Watergate. Actually, Coppola was working on the conversation way before Watergate. Coppola said he would make The Godfather 2 if he could make the conversation. And Coppola was not influenced by Watergate, but Michelangelo Antonioni's blow-up. Now, a movie that was influenced by Watergate and was about Watergate was All the President's Men, directed by Alan J. Pakula, starring Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman as Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, the Washington Post reporters who kept the Watergate story in the papers.
Unit 1 to Unit 2.
What?
We're home.
Base 1 to Unit 1. Base 1 to Unit 1.
Hold it, you mother! Hold it! Police!
There's been a break-in at Democratic headquarters. They were bugging the place.
Woodward, Bernstein, you're both on the story now. Don't fuck it up.
Redford.
I'm Bob Woodward of the Washington Post. Mr. Markham, are you here in connection with the Watergate burglary?
I'm not here.
Hoffman.
Hi, this is Carl Bernstein of the Washington Post, and I was just wondering if you can remember...
All the President's Men. The story of the two young reporters who cracked the Watergate conspiracy.
White House.
Howard Hunt, please.
He might be in Mr. Colson's office.
Who's Charles Colson? Did you know, Howard Hunt?
Well, the White House said he was doing some investigative work.
What do you say?
They stumbled into leads.
Certainly it comes as no surprise to you that Howard was with the CIA.
No surprise at all.
They tripped over clues.
We'd like to see all the material requested by the White House.
All White House transactions are confidential.
This whole thing is a cover-up. It's right on our nose.
And piece by piece, they solve the greatest detective story in American history.
There is no way the White House can control the investigation.
I don't want to say anymore, okay?
Have you been threatened if you tell the truth?
Is there a cover-up?
Don't you understand what you're on to?
Mitchell knew?
Of course, Mitchell knew.
Woodward! Bernstein! Get in here!
At times, it looked as if it might cost them their jobs.
You guys are about to write a story that says the former attorney general, the highest-ranking law enforcement officer in this country, is a crook.
Their reputations.
Why is the Post trying to do it? I don't know.
Perhaps even their lives.
It's a great detective movie about investigative journalism, and both movies, The Conversation and All the President's Men, capture the paranoia of the day. Also, I want to recommend another Alan J. Pakula film that we have in our collection called Clute, which is also about paranoia. It deals with a prostitute being stalked by a killer, and it stars Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland. So, Amanda, your turn.
I'm going to go a little different direction.
Clute?
That's what they expect you to say.
So I am a child of the 1970s. Now, just barely, but I do claim the decade of disco as my own. So it is with great shock and awe that I found out that one of my favorite tween books, before tween was really called tween, Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, was actually written in 1972. It was written by the incomparable Judy Blume, and Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing is part of a 4-5 book series that features Peter Hatcher and his younger brother Fudge. And I say 4-5 book series because there are technically 4 Fudge books, but most people also throw in Otherwise Known as Sheila the Grey as the second book in the series. Now, personally, I don't count that one because Pete and Fudge aren't really in it that much, and I don't like Sheila Tubman enough to read a whole book just about her. So the first book in the series is Tales, like I mentioned, and then that's followed by Super Fudge, Fudgemania, and then Double Fudge, which just came out recently. Tales is the only one that is an official 1970s book, though. So I can't remember when I first read these exactly, but to the best of my recollection, I think I read them around third grade, somewhere in there. So this would make it somewhere in the mid to late 1980s. But it also means that I probably only had the first two to read, because Super Fudge came out in 1980, that's the second one, and then the third one, Fudgemania, didn't come out until 1990. And I didn't even realize that Double Fudge had come out until I sat down to reread the books for this podcast, because it didn't come out all the way until 2007, and I feel like I should be banished from the human race for not knowing that. But I did read it, so I'm all caught up, all official with my Fudge books.
Is he grown up?
What the fudge?
No, see, that's the thing. They're still, like, he's 5. So, like, it started when he was 3, and now 40 years later, he's 5.
Wow.
But, like, technology changed with it as they went through. Like,
what happened to Bob Adams?
Playing MP3s and getting emails, and I'm like, you're...
That's kind of weird.
Still playing records, but now they're hipster records.
So, anyway, for those of you who haven't read about Pete and Fudge, the stories are set in New York City. A member in good standing of the Firstborn Club, Peter Hatcher, is a 4th grader. Thank you, title. He gets repeatedly embarrassed by his... I guess he's 2 years old in the first book, Fudges. Pete's best friend, Jimmy, lives in their building, but so does Sheila Tubman, who they've dubbed their great the cootie queen. She's Sheila the Great. These stories follow the life with the Hatcher family as turtles get awarded and then eaten, shoes are left on subways, and grandmas marry grandpas. Now, when I read these for the first time, I remember thinking that Fudge was so funny, but now that I've kind of gotten a few more years or, you know, decades, whatever, under my belt, I kind of mostly think he needs a spanking. And the interesting thing is that Blume admits that she based the character Fudge on her son Larry, and so I don't really know what this says about her mothering abilities, but it definitely worked to help build her career.
Name a kid Larry, it's probably fun.
I guess.
That's the lesson.
That's fair. Poor Larry.
So she recruited by kind of Fudge.
So Judy Blume, she's been a mainstay of children's literature for decades, but she also writes books for adults, and she just recently put out a book called In the Unlikely Event that deals with 3 plane crashes that happened in her hometown of Elizabeth, New Jersey when she was a child. Now, her father was a dentist, and he was actually called into the crime scene, to the crash scenes, to identify the bodies. And Blume says she's kind of repressed these memories until just recently, and this book kind of comes out of her healing process in trying to deal with them. So let's all run out and read that together.
That's pretty heavy, Judy Blume.
Yeah. I'm like, can't we just throw cereal at each other? Come on. So the latest book... the latest Fudge book was written because of Blume's grandson, Elliot. He begged her to come up with some more books about Fudge and Peter. And at the end of the edition I read that we have here in Double Fudge, there's an interview with Judy Blume, and she leaves the door open. So in 10 years, there could be another, because it seems she does it like every 10 to 12 years.
That's like the ultimate fan service when your grandkid read, like if you're a classic author, you know, and then your grandkids are like, hey, grandma, can you write?
Like, yeah, most grandkids would be like, you write stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, have some sweet tarts.
Yeah, it's like, I want a Twinkie.
I want a Twinkie.
Anarchy!
I got frozen Snickers from my grandparents. It was nice.
I got diabetes for mine.
Yeah. You wonder why I'm huge right now.
All right, Mr. Mike, I'm done.
So, weirdly enough, choosing something to talk about this time was rather easy. Like this morning, I was thinking, well, I could talk about new wave science fiction, and the 70s being the golden age of Clint Eastwood movies.
You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Or the works of Blue Oyster Cult.
Hey.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't fear. I got you covered on that, don't worry.
Awesome.
The OC.
Far out. But I rather rapidly settled upon a favorite subgenre of mine lately, the 70s crime picture. Not really sure why, but crime movies in the 70s have a different feel than other eras. You know, noir is pretty cool, but it could be incredibly formulaic, you know. What's this? Your incredibly hot girlfriend got you to kill her husband for the insurance money and has now pulled a gun on you? I totally didn't see that coming. And crime movies lately either want to ape Tarantino or feel like the screenwriter filled out a special noir edition of Mad Libs. Unfortunately, I've already talked about one of my most favorite recent discoveries, the Taking of Pelham 123, during the Best Movies of 2014 Roundup last December. And I try not to recommend the same thing twice, so today I thought I would talk about the other really good Walter Matthau-helmed crime movie of the 1970s, Charlie Varick from 1973, directed by Don Siegel.
Varick? You've seen Charlie Varick?
You're an interesting man, Mr. Varick. Last of the Independents.
Oh, my God. You want to die for somebody else's money?
Half a million?
Could be.
Harold Young, Trace Cruz's bank manager, has estimated that the bandits escaped with less than $2,000.
Who are they kidding? Us?
It's 10-1. This stuff belongs to the mafia. This is gambling money skimmed off the top. The mafia kills you. No trial, no judge. They never stop looking for you, not till you're dead. I'd rather have 10 FBIs after me.
One man against the mafia.
Bang! This little bank a million miles from nowhere gets hit by four professionals. Now they're going to think that's strange.
Why couldn't it be just a coincidence?
Because they don't believe in coincidence.
Prop dusters don't wave guns. Put that thing away fast.
Well, we're going to get them. I'll never get out of New Mexico. I feel that in my gut.
Might want to fence off some money.
Hot.
Burning up.
What do you want?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to scare you. Which doesn't mean I won't throw you right out that window if I have to.
Sooner or later, you're going to tell me everything you know. So why not save yourself a great deal of pain? Where's Charles Varick?
When Charlie Varick runs out of dumb luck, he always has genius to fall back on.
Stars the eponymous Varick, a crop duster slash amateur thief. At the beginning of the film, his gang hits a bank in sleepy Trace Cruces, New Mexico, but unfortunately, in the...
Trace Cruces, New Mexico?
That's what it's called.
A crop duster and amateur thief?
Yeah. You know, he's keeping busy. He's the Elvis Costello of petty crime.
Petty crime himself.
Who's the guy in the Donald Westlake books that's like, he runs a theater and he's a...
You're fired.
Yeah. I have those books. They're sitting on my shelf.
Well, that's what really I'm saying. Cool, like, hey, you know? I got this job that probably didn't pay a lot of money. I better steal stuff too.
Yeah, that's how they work.
I thought of a book series about a librarian.
Yeah, who does crimes? Cool. I want to be a jugger. Unfortunately, in the ensuing shootout slash car chase, two of the gang are killed, leaving only Varick and young Harmon Sullivan, who's played by Andy Robinson, who played the serial killer Scorpio in Dirty Harry.
Oh, he was also Garrick on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Spoiler alert. And the deep dead Hellraiser, as well as some sort of Cardassian, I guess, in that Deep Space Nine thing.
Which Cardassian.
Whatever. When they finally make it to Varick's rundown sketchy trailer, they discover that while they're spending a haul of maybe $5,000, they made out with over $700,000. Which, if I remember correctly, if you take into account inflation in 1970s dollars, that could buy you the moon. Yet the radio says they only made it out with $2,000, which, if I remember correctly, and counting inflation and stuff, could only buy 10 houses. In a move I find really interesting, Varick recommends that they don't spend any of the money for like 3 to 4 years. He's like really cautious and like, you know, weary and stuff. He quickly surmises that a very powerful somebody who's using the bank as a money laundering operation, and very dangerous people will soon be looking for them. I think that's really cool, you know, you get to know him as like a character, he's really smart, yet, you know, not great with money. You know, hence the crop duster slash amateur thief. Of course, young hothead Sullivan will have none of this. Ooh. John Vernon of Animal House fame and being the mayor in Dirty Harry, and you know, go watch Dirty Harry, plays a mob boss who wants his money back. And Joe Don Baker plays the hitman who's sent to find the money.
Mitchell.
That's right. He looks like a moon in A Trip to the Moon. And that is true. Joe Don Baker plays for me. Joe Don Baker plays for me the most memorable character he's in his career. Note that I still haven't seen Walking Tall.
Have you seen Mitchell?
I've seen the Mystery Science Theater version of Mitchell. And there, you know, I mean, granted, I think he only sticks in my brain this time solely because instead of renting hotel rooms, he rents rooms at brothels. But still. Charlie Varick is a fun little crime movie. The music by Lalo Schifrin of Mission Impossible fame is really good. The character is really memorable, and the ending is, like, fantastic. It's available on Hoopla. Check it out.
Does it all take place in New Mexico?
Yes.
Awesome.
Cool.
Even better.
I have a thing that there's something about the film stock in this 1970s, and I think I brought this up before. I posed this question to Bill and Clint before, but I think it makes crime movies look like...
Yeah, like grittier.
Grimy or something, yeah, and I think it has to do with the film stock or just the way that the cinematographers were thinking in the 70s.
Well, I think some of it, too, is like the... Like, he was talking about, like, the distrust in public institutions, and, like, I think that... And maybe it's a romantic idea, but, like, that attitude seemed to, like, the best stuff that comes from that era.
Now the criminal sort of is like, hero because it's like subversive and stuff.
Yeah, and it's just, I think, like, all the best stuff from that era is just sort of soaked up all that sort of, like, animosity toward
people
and official.
And it happened already, and that's why Inherent Vice couldn't be a good movie. Because there's movies like Clute and Charlie Varick right there. All right, so I'm going to go different. I'm going to typically...
What?
But
I'm going to talk about the Bee Gees. Well,
now the works of ABBA.
I am going to talk about a musical group that is perhaps as hated as the Bee Gees. If there's one band associated with the overindulgence of the 1970s and prog rock, it is the band Yes. Now, supposedly the 1970s punk rock came to wash prog away, but if you spend any time listening to punk rock, you'll quickly discover that it's actually really boring and repetitive.
Pretty much.
So if you if you want to go on a musical adventure, a sonic quest, then there is always the music of Yes. That's a sample from the Cosmic Symphony, Close to the Edge. So if you like speed scales, multiple time changes, and intergalactic mysticism,
yes,
then dig deep into the albums from Yes's classic period, Fragile, Close to the Edge, Tales from Topographic Oceans, and Relayer. All of those records are on Hoopla for sure. We might have them in other formats. For most of those records, their keyboardist, which you just heard, was Rick Wakeman of prog giants Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Brain cell surgery.
The drummer for the first half of those records was Bill Bruford, who went on to form a little band called King Crimson. These guys are prog royalty. The mystical lyrics and John Anderson's lilting voice are not what I like about Yes. What I like about Yes is the funk. Wait, the funk, this is the most anti-funk band in the world. But I think it's like alien funk. If aliens from a different cosmic dimension played funk, it would sound like Yes. I love them when they just let it rip. I hear that, I just think of the final scene of Encounters of the Third Kind, but when the aliens get off the ship, you know, like they push a button and like weird sci-fi instruments appear, and then they just start playing that, and the humans are just
the lights are going
and the humans are just in there like So that's every time I when Yes just lets it rip, that's I always just think of that. Of those four albums I mentioned, that's my favorite period of Yes. I think that's sort of the classic Yes that most people think of. The band has gone through many lineup and stylistic changes over the years and had hits in all their periods, but the one constant through all of that was bassist and songwriter Chris Squire. Squire passed away just a few weeks ago. Cheers to you, man. Your music is transcendent, and it has brought a lot of pleasure and joy into my life the last few years. If you ever have like a long night, either because you're partying or you're anxious or whatever, and you find yourself the sun's coming up, just put on headphones and listen to Heart at the Sunrise off Fragile, and you will be transported. So thank you, Chris Squire, for all the great music that you made.
That was the song that did it for me, that brought me into the fold.
Now, if you're a library nerd and you want to go even deeper, there are books just about Yes and about prog rock. Both are written by Bill Martin. So there's The Music of Yes, Structure and Vision in Progressive Rock, and Listening to the Future, The Time of Progressive Rock, which is about all those other bands I mentioned too, not just Yes. Now, Mr. Martin has always been interested in utopian visions. He is a lifelong communist and a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party. He's also a philosophy professor at DePaul University. A few years back, his books were banned from the third grade elementary school curriculum in Texas.
Oh, really?
Yeah, overthrow the teacher and become a people's proletariat case.
And this was because we know that the third graders really wanted to read his titles, Ethical Marxism, The Categorical Imperative of Liberation.
Well, that's basically what I just said. Yeah, okay.
And don't forget the one book that tied for me for my favorite childhood book besides Tales of Fourth Grade Nothing.
Oh boy.
The Politics of the Impasse, Exploration in Post-Secular Social Theory.
Children love books that have a title and then a colon and then a long subtitle. They love it.
Now, that's a good nightstand read just before bed.
Yeah. If it says toward a something, colon, explorations of something, now, children will just
kids dig impasses.
Now, this led to the other Bill Martin, the childhood author of Brown Bear, What Do You See? Who's like semi-classic, very popular children's author. His books being banned in Texas because someone on the Texas Board of Education confused the two Bill Martins and thought they were the same person.
Texas.
And Texas
That's
is
a heck of a back catalog
Texas
right there.
Is responsible for much of the textbooks in the country.
Yes, because they have the largest. There's been school news circulating about that recently. Yeah.
So this is a really good, funny library story. It demonstrates the absurdity of censorship.
And Texas.
And also...
Sweaty because it's true.
Careful, the Rangers may come after you for messing with
Bring
it.
Bring it, Walker.
I'll take Chuck Norris.
And a shout out to Mike. Also, the importance of good metadata and authority control.
Yes.
To know the difference between the two Bill Martins.
The authority records are quite different. I don't know.
Hey, what did we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Why, it's something that the library may have.
Maybe we have it.
Or
maybe
it may
don't.
Not have it. But either way,
it's Tickle My Fancy.
Hey, good, great save, man. I totally meant to do. I meant just to go back and do that, but let's do it again.
Hey, what did we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Maybe the library has it. Maybe the library doesn't.
But either way, it's tickling our fancy
this week.
A brief tickle my fancy just came out yesterday. Go Set the Watchman by Harper Lee, a follow-up to the classic To Kill a Mockingbird. This is Harper Lee's first book in 54 years. So it's probably got a long hold list now, but you might be able to come in.
Yes, it does.
And get it at a Lucky Day collection. Luck out that those were gone just like that yesterday, too. But anyway, just to let you know, it is now out. You can put it on hold. Go Set the Watchman, the follow-up to Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. Jeremy,
well,
what's
tickling
your
fancy? Well, I want to say I didn't get my hold in time, and so I'm 359 on the list. So if you have a copy, finish it. The rest of us are waiting.
It was only 353 when I saw it.
Yeah, see, I like having fun. Like, it used to be about last week. You could check it every, like, I don't know, 20 minutes, and it's getting higher and higher. It was kind of fun as like a little game. Like, has it gone up 4 this time?
It's or still like not as big as Harry Potter. Harry Potter had like 500 when that last one came
in. I was really surprised when I first heard about it. Like, I saw it seemed like it was like right under 100 for a
Yeah,
really
it was.
Long time.
Yeah, it's dated. And like, I thought I had a hold on it. And I was like, where's my hold? I'm like, crap.
It must have like, ramped up the promotion.
What?
I was number 2.
When the
snap card.
I'm not cool like that.
Oh, la ti da. Oh, well, well.
I gotta throw down like a competitive snap card.
Pardon me, would you have any gray poupon?
That is just you know, being from the north, finding out that someone named, you know, Atticus Finch in Alabama in 1950 was a racist is not a surprise to me at all.
That's fair.
Okay. So that being said, Jerry, what were you?
Oh, speaking of stoners, I guess, from before.
In Alabama in the 50s.
So, yeah, speaking of Alabama.
Before they got killed, you know.
Google's deep dream tickles my brain stem by putting dog faces and slug appendages on everything from Johnny Depp to pornography. And it is glorious. I envision a bright, fractal-laden future where Google Glass makes a comeback and lets users see the world in a deep dream state, thus making everyday Terrence McKenna-level tripping possible without breaking the law or altering your brain chemistry. So I yesterday had a desire, like almost unstoppable desire, to put every photograph I own through this thing. And it made me, started making me paranoid, and it made me think I was creating a facial recognition machine or like creating Skynet. But maybe I should say what Google's deep dream is.
I was
going to
say, for those of you who don't know what it is.
If you don't know, just do it. It's beautiful. So they've like created this like thing that mimics neurons and like the way humans see things or something. It's some sort of artificial intelligent experiment that's going to take over the world or whatever, and you put a photograph in it and it alters it by like doing something to the edges. I don't know what the technical, so there's some sort of code, and then basically it like graphs this crazy layer of images on it, so like, and then it all ends up being like dogs and like weird slug kind
marmots.
Of thing. Yeah, and like a friend of mine did it with, she has like long red hair, and her hair looked like her hair was like foxes sort of, and then her face became this like just like fur mask. And someone at the Nashville Scene, maybe we should link to this, the Nashville Scene did a bunch of like Nashville icons, and this plate of hot chicken looked like this dog, and it just it is monstrous and weird. And then sometimes if there's like an empty space where there's like light in the background, like these little structures appear or little vehicles and stuff, and it just
so can you unplug it when it wants to come back and kill Sarah Connor?
No.
So I also have a question about, you know, a couple of these apps, like that one that guessed your age, whatever, kept your picture, like they said.
I'm sure.
So is this like one of those, if you look at the fine print, it'll be like, well, technically we own every picture that Jeremy's ever had.
I didn't put every photograph I've ever done. But I assume that there's probably some nefarious thing on it. Because, well, what it is like, it's a free code that you can download from them. And Brian said there's like a lot of technical mumbo-jumbo. So someone took a site where you could upload it and then they email it to you, I'm sure. And then they want you to like post it on social media and hashtag it. A dream or whatever, but I'm sure, like, you know, I probably gave up rights to things that I, you know what, at this point, I have a Facebook account and I have a Gmail account. My private life is over. It's fine.
You got a point there.
I'm done. So
your photographs are facially recognized in the largest photographic database in the history of the world.
Exactly.
If you're on Facebook.
Exactly.
Even if you delete your account.
Exactly. So yeah, like it's over. My son is tagged for life.
Are you one of those parents who, like, meticulously, like, every event in his life you put on, like, social media?
I like to sort of experience his life.
Okay.
But then sometimes I'm like, do that again.
So
I like him to perform like a monkey.
Yeah, I read an article on that once where, like, you know, the next generation will have the weird privilege of, like, knowing that their entire lives have been put online.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And how, like, you know, some parents are, you know, not doing that on purpose.
Yeah.
Well, like, no one experiences anything anymore because they're on their stupid phone.
Yeah, going to a concert sometimes. Yeah, somebody's putting up their iPad, like, covering up.
I don't do that. I punch
those people.
The worst.
Oh, did you hear what Patti LuPone did? She was doing a Broadway performance and somebody was texting. And then after intermission, she still came back and texted. So Patti LuPone just walked over in the middle of the performance, grabbed the phone, and smashed it against the wall. And everybody cheered.
Yeah. Who texted her now?
Seriously, you've had to see Patti LuPone.
And you guys heard about the person that plugged their phone in on stage doing Broadway shows?
Too. I heard about that.
Too.
Yeah.
It's like, no idea.
Yeah, during a live performance, who does that? That's just...
So, like, were they on drugs or are they just?
How do they have their charge cord? That's what.
Yeah, on their person.
Because I don't carry mine around.
If you're responsible enough to have your phone, your charger,
you never know when you might need.
We should be responsible enough to sort of like charge it ahead of time.
All right, Mike, what's taking your fancy besides the internet taking over our world?
Well, the fancy tickler segment has been biting me on the butt lately. Like this week.
Can you leave me alone?
Say what?
I was redacting a no-no word I can't say on a family-friendly podcast. Like this week, I would recommend a Pelham 123, but no, I already did recommend it. Or for French stuff, I would have recommended District B13, but no, I already recommended it. Or for Australian stuff, I would have recommended the Rover,
what
but
you say? Mike is having a stroke, tickling my fancy. Aneurysms.
So I've watched a movie this week that's definitely in my top five for the year, and I listened to a song that was on infinite repeat yesterday that I think will go in my top five music that actually came out this year, as opposed to last year when I recommended a bunch of songs that came out within the past 20 years. But I'm not recommending them. Nope. Aww. You'll have to live in suspense, damn it. No new word that I did not mind saying. So this week I'm recommending an exhibit at the Vanderbilt Fine Arts Gallery. Ooh. Up close and personal and intimate devotions and everyday objects from late antiquity. But for those who aren't into personal goods from the late Roman Empire, you could get down to the clown with Thrills and Chills, the fantastic world of the American circus. Good times. Pro tip, it is within walking distance of Hillsborough Village. Also, the entrance is not facing the East Street, which, you know, it took me like 20 minutes of, where am I? It's in this building, right? It says art. I'm confused. What's with these people? Shaking my cane. Throwing my walker. Also, the exhibit there, you know, Fine Arts Gallery is completely free.
Shaking your cane?
Yeah, that's right. Kids these days. I went to go see their exhibit, Memento Mori, looking at death and art and illustration earlier this year, and it was super cool. Downside is that there is no catalog to buy, so if your memory fades of this exhibit years from now, you won't have a Memento Mori of your own to remind you of it. Irony.
I think that everyday antiquity thing was at the Frist a couple of years ago, maybe a few years ago.
Cool. Well, this time it's free. Cheapskates.
Hey, what's at Frist right now, Jeremy?
Postcards of the Wiener Werkstatt.
I love it. I love it. I love that so much. I had to get that in there. I mean,
the Italian fashion since 1945.
Okay, so I was going to see if you were done.
I'm not going to talk about this.
No.
So I was on vacation last week in the subarctic north, where it was a delightful 60 degrees every day.
Whoa.
So I missed the fun last week with the clocks from Jeremy's dad, so I just was going to use my tickle my
finger. Correction!
Sorry, Mike's dad. Sorry, Mike's
dad. Sorry, Dad. I'm taking away Amanda's clock right now. I'll have two, one for my house and one for work.
No, it's fine. So anyway, so I wanted to say thank you to Mike's dad, who is our number one fan, for giving us a nice little gift. And I would also like to issue a challenge to Gary from Perth. Now, in order to beat this, you're going to have to hand carve me a boomerang that's also hand painted, because this clock is pretty nice.
Nice.
So,
I would like a didgeridoo.
This is so weird, but there's a boomerang from Australia on my coffee table right now.
From Gary from Perth?
Gary from Perth gets around.
I've got one.
He likes Brian better because he's
the host. I don't know why that's there. Oh, you do know why it's there. A friend brought it back.
Mad Max thing or something.
So you got a boomerang and Jeremy only got that stupid shirt when his friend over. It was a plate. Yes. I'm sorry.
We had the plate.
I met Jetta from Sydney last week. My in-laws, some friend of theirs.
I already have a boomerang, so I want some Vegemite.
Okay, you can have my Vegemite.
Colin Hay is playing at the Fontanelle with Bare Naked Ladies and Violent Femmes.
Alta Mora Bar is the greatest candy bar that ever existed. Mm. It's chocolate.
We just need to go to Australia.
Yeah, I'd like to go.
Field trip.
Hi.
Australian episode 2.
Andre Roux is Dutch.
Of course he is.
I only mention that because I phrased it in such a way as if he was French. I think I said you can find more Andre Roux albums and other French stuff. You know, I didn't mean to imply that he was French.
I'm just spoiling our future Dutch episode.
Well, as I talked about, the French can't be cookies.
I claim Ronald Reagan. I don't know.
How come the French flag is like this and the Dutch flag is like this?
I don't know.
You're European.
Le Seinfeld.
This is an audio podcast. No one saw those gestures.
Yeah.
But I
didn't miss much.
It was in my voice. No, it wasn't really good gestures.
Were there any other corrections?
I have some corrections. I realized later on that not every edition of The Three Musketeers / 20 Years After will be heavily annotated. Wah. I read the Oxford Classics edition of 20 Years After, which I found really helpful. The Omni Hut's teriyaki sauce contains honey and not pineapple. But this allows it to never go bad, as the nice hostess lady told me at least.
So you're
TMI.
That's okay. It's pretty fresh.
A couple of days ago, I marinated pork strips with a half bottle of their teriyaki sauce I got about 7 months ago, and it tasted just fine.
Wow.
Oh. But the pineapple was really heavy in their Hawaiian tea. I've since read on their website that while the restaurant itself is alcohol-free, they do not mind a few BYOB. So you can sneak in some rum, put it in that Hawaiian tea. Good times. And then this bit's for me, and Brian can cut it out. But Brian is not no Smiles McKilljoy. He smiles sometimes, like when lumping wonderful Wes Anderson with nightmare hack Michael Bay in the Criterion Sellouts category. You monster. I noticed that later. It wasn't like an hour later. I was like, wait a minute.
I'm looking at your desk. Hey.
Hang on. That's wait a minute.
I am with the majority that he made awesome movies up until Life Aquatic, and now I kind of feel like he's treading water. I will admit that many people have told me that Moonrise Kingdom and Budapest Hotel and even Fantastic Mr. Fox were like, awesome, and I should check those out.
Fantastic Mr. Fox, I like better than all those.
Life Aquatic's okay. The ones after that.
I dig it.
I think it's better.
Brian needs to give Wes Anderson another try. So for all of these Wes Anderson movies and the filmmakers I talked about earlier, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Next week,
vacation!
Yeah.
Summer vacation for you!
Gotta get away.
But not for us.
Not even America. Not even not for us. We're gonna be talking about that. When I was in high school and I was in a band and my dad, or I played bass in a band, and my dad said, you play bass, you should listen to Rush, because they got some bass playing. And I was like, this sucks, it's stupid. If he had said, you should listen to Yes, maybe things might have turned out differently for me. But so thanks for steering me wrong, man.
This might split the table, but I totally agree with you. I love Yes. I cannot stand Rush.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's...
I've tried to get into Rush, but
I can't.
Well, actually, I do know what it is. It's Geddy Lee's voice. Yeah.
I don't find... Well, maybe I've not listened to the right stuff, too. Because, I worked at Great Escape in college and stuff, and they would just always put it on the classic rock channel. And so you're going to hear, Working Man and Tom Sawyer all the damn time.
I don't like Rush either.
I don't hate Rush.
Yet another tip and stop car drop down. No one cares about.
While I was in college, this guy said, we just moved to college in the dorm, and this one guy said, y'all like Rush? And said, yeah, it's fine if that's what, we were trying to be agreeable, and he played it all the time at maximum volume for the first 3 weeks. But the good news was he drank a bottle of cough syrup, freaked out, and chased everybody around the dorm with a whip. And so they kicked him out of the dorm. So That's
all. That's what Russia did, yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, is this a 70s story to tie it in?
This is an early 80s story.
Oh, okay.
82 to be exact. Wow. September of 82.
Wow. Awesome.